Well, several months ago on my birthday, Paul DiBolli was with us as we talked about a number of different issues. Up next, we'll do kind of a round robin case with Paul about the Kennedy assassination, and we'll take your calls later on tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me tell you about Paul DiBolli. Paul is an assistant professor of political science at LaSalle College in Newton, Massachusetts. He teaches courses like the American presidency, American political institutions, the politics and history of the Cold War, the conspiracy in American politics, white collar and organized crime, terrorism and issues in national security as well. Prior to teaching, he was working at and has been a consultant to several government agencies, including the United States Marshal Service and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Executive Office of Public Safety. He also worked on as a campaign aide to the late Senators John McCain and Lamar Alexander. Paul, welcome back. Good to have you.
Oh, thank you, George, for having me very much. I really appreciate it.
And we'll have you round out tonight. We've had different thoughts and theories. I got to tell you, will we ever get to the point, though, where we get this whole situation solved?
Well, it depends on what you mean when you say solved. I mean, you know, a couple of standards of proof, like if this was a civil case, for example, it would be a preponderance of the evidence, and I think that's what we're, I think that's the standard that we're looking for. I mean, we're never going to have a videotape of the gunman, you know, taking that fatal shot. We're never going to have a confession. So I think we just have to prove to a reasonable degree of likelihood, you know, what our conclusion is in the case, so.
Now, when we talked last, we talked about some different happenings about JFK, of course. Anything new?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You know, the research has kind of been going really, really well lately. And one of the things that I had unearthed that I hadn't seen before was this connection between Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover.
Mm-hmm. They were pretty close.
Would it surprise you to know that they lived across the street from each other for 19 years?
You mean in D.C.?
In D.C., yeah. Their address in Northwest, they were literally across the street and two houses away. And, you know, Rosemary Lincoln, who was President Kennedy's longtime secretary and confidant, had written a book in 1968 in which she kind of quoted JFK saying, I'm paraphrasing here, is that horrible Mr. Hoover blackmailed President Kennedy into putting Lyndon Johnson on the ticket in 1960, and he threatened to expose his, you know, his womanizing, et cetera.
Womanizing, yeah.
You have to wonder to what end. Why did Hoover do something? Hoover didn't do something unless there was something in it for Hoover. And although Johnson was a good friend, you know, quote unquote friend of the FBI, you know, one might think that who would be, you know, again, you know, times were different in 1960. Hoover, you know, may have had an alternative lifestyle. Hoover had a history of using FBI agents to maintain his home, paint his trim, prepare his taxes, et cetera. And who better to know what was going on than, you know, his across the street neighbor. So I kind of have this pet theory that it might have been Johnson who was, you know, manipulating the puppet strings, and that Hoover was was his instrument for getting a lot of that done. But we're still completing the research on that. But it does pose an interesting theory.
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah,
well, it's funny too. I was actually reading a book as part of the research for my book, and it was like my 30 years in the FBI by a gentleman named Bill Sullivan. Excuse me, He describes a scene where he's sitting down with John Dean about, you know, coordinating some FBI activity to coincide with Nixon's enemy list, et cetera. And John Dean said, "Well, I bet you the Kennedys used you guys a lot." And Sullivan's response was that, no, the Kennedys kind of kept us at arm's length. There was this antagonism between, you know, Mr. Hoover and President Kennedy, and they never used us for very many things. And then John Dean looked at him and said, "Well, what about the John?" He said, "How do we rate in relation to other administrations?" And Sullivan looked at him and said, "Compared to the Johnson administration, your use of the FBI is Spartan."
Well, we had a number of guests on tonight, Paul, talking about their various theories, and one, of course, is convinced that the Secret Service is culpable, primarily negligent, but he does believe that they had several agents that might have been involved in this. What do you think?
I don't think that. I don't like to poo-poo somebody's research, but I you know, when you say culpability of the Secret Service, I mean, you have to look back at the fact that Secret Service was founded in 1865. They didn't take over presidential protection until 1901. So from 1901 to 1963, presidential protection was really in its infancy. Originally, when it was started, there were 8 guys on the presidential protection detail. There were 32 on the presidential protection detail in 1963. There's over 300 on the detail now. They were put into a protective role, but not into a proactive, anticipatory role that we have right now. So I think part of that is the natural evolution of an agency. I mean, I have a copy of the duty roster for November 22nd, 1963. There's only 29 agents in Dallas.
Oh, that's it?
That's it, including the vice president's detail, the president's detail, the first lady's detail. And I think there were less than a dozen in the motorcade. You know, some people were still at Love Field securing Air Force Ones.
Right, and only a couple around the president.
Only a real handful. And I think what your guest might have been alluding to is there were a number of witnesses that ran towards the grassy knoll after the fatal shot.
Yes, that's right.
And there are a lot of claims that they were confronted by men in business suits identifying themselves as Secret Service agents. And even a couple of the police officers, testified that Secret Service agents were, you know, on the grassy knoll. But the duty roster doesn't list any Secret Service agents assigned to that area. And I was wondering, okay, who could these guys in the dark suits brandishing the credentials be? And I remember back when I was in college, I had read G. Gordon Liddy's autobiography, Will. And I remember a passage in there about him getting Treasury credentials so that he could carry legal in Washington, D.C. Trotted out my copy of the book, and, you know, I reread that section. One of the offices in Treasury HQ used to keep Treasury badges and blank, you know, credential inserts in the office. And basically, Liddy dummied up a memo, put it in this file. He was issued with Treasury credentials, and he became a Treasury agent. And then he says, it was odd that they kept those there, but you have to remember what it was for. And those were for CIA agents, because, you know, the CIA, their statutory mandate is for foreign intelligence work and foreign surveillance. They have very, very little power in the U.S., although they were engaged in a lot of domestic activities. And all that had to happen is the CIA headquarters would have to send a request to the Undersecretary for Administration and Finance. A set of credentials were issued in whatever name they asked, and then CIA officers suddenly became Treasury officers. So if you like the whole CIA angle on the assassination, it makes perfect sense that the guys in the dark suits brandishing the Treasury Department credentials were actually CIA officers. And we know that in 1963, the U.S. Secret Service was part of the Department of the Treasury. So it's easy for someone to infer Treasury credentials being Secret Service. But again, 29 agents on duty, nobody on duty in Dealey. As a matter of fact, the first Secret Service agent.
What would you call it? Negligence? Stupidity? What was that? And the car was uncovered.
Car was uncovered, which was President Kennedy's choice at the time. I am very, very reluctant to call it stupidity or negligence. I think they had a set of procedures. I don't think the protective procedures had matured to the level that we see today.
Now, let me ask you, you know, we're all talking about, and we have for years, the Zapruder film. Mm-hmm. But you talk about something called Orville Nix in that film. Tell us about Orville Nix, first of all.
Orville Nix was this really interesting gentleman. He was an HVAC repairman for the General Services Administration. And he had gone to Dealey Plaza that day with his new movie camera to photograph the presidential motorcade and to photograph the president. And there's a great and there's all kinds of controversy as to whether the film was altered before it was returned to him or not. But there's a great piece of film available on YouTube, and it's the Orville Nix film shown at 25 at one quarter speed, 25% speed. And if you watch the film very carefully, and he was photographing from across the street from where Abraham Zapruder was. So if you look at Abraham Zapruder and his film, you see at frame 313 is the fatal shot, and it appears as though the fatal shot comes from the front right-hand side of the president, impacts him on the front right-hand side of his head. But then if you watch the Orville Nix film at 25% speed, what you see is this pink cloud at the front of his head. And then it appears as though the cloud, and it's due to the motion of the limousine, the cloud just moves back to his head and then dissipates. And you can see a small chunk of something coming off, which appears to be a portion of the president's skull. And it's just, and that taken in conjunction with the Zapruder film would more tend to indicate a shot coming from the front. But, you know, it's independent validation of the Zapruder film, but it's actually a much better angle. And when you see that cloud, it is absolutely the most amazing piece of photography I've ever seen.
What do you think the cloud is? Is it gun smoke?
No, the cloud is basically when the skull is very dense. When a bullet enters the skull, it displaces the material that's there already. Okay, skin at the outside, bone, cerebral fluid, blood, etc.
Dust.
And that displaced material has no place to go until there's an exit wound. So in that fraction of a second when the bullet enters the skull, all of that material gets extrudes from the entry wound until there's an exit wound. And then any displaced material goes, so in JFK's case, it would go out the back. So
it's like the remnants of when you drill into wood.
Sure. I mean, they call it blowback, but that's exactly what happens. So if you see frame 313 of the Zapruder film, it's clear that there's a headshot. If you couple that with the Orville Nix film, there's no other conclusion that you can come to other than the fact that the bullet came from the front right.
Are you convinced, Paul, that one, there was a conspiracy, and two, there were more than one shooter there at the time?
There would have to be more than one shooter. For the bullet wound to enter President Kennedy's skull in the front right would seem to indicate a shooter coming from in front of President Kennedy. And as I started to say, that Secret Service agent, a gentleman named Forrest Sorrells, who was head of the Dallas Secret Service Office, was in the lead car. His statements clearly indicate that the bullet came from slightly behind him and to the right, which is consistent with a bullet, you know, with a shot coming from the grassy knoll. And then they bring Forrest Sorrells into the Warren Commission, and they do not ask him one question about where the bullet came from. They questioned him about how Oswald was held in custody, what were the security measures, etc. So you have one of the most believable, most experienced witnesses on the scene, and they don't ask him any questions about where the shot originated.
Why not?
They were so wedded to the magic bullet theory.
Because they were told to come up with that theory, weren't they?
Well, I think that the Warren Commission basically acted as a rubber stamp for the FBI investigation, and my theory is that Lyndon Johnson was actually pulling the strings on the FBI investigation. But if you look at the witnesses that they identified, the Warren Commission questioned, I think, 552 witnesses. There were 670 people in Dealey Plaza. So when you factor in the forensics experts, the people that knew Oswald before, the people that knew Oswald in the military, et cetera, I think something like less than 100 witnesses were interviewed before the Warren Commission. And there seems to be a pattern of ignoring the 40-plus witnesses that said that the gunshot came from the grassy knoll rather than the Texas School Book Depository, and they only called those witnesses if they just couldn't avoid calling them.
Right. There was a person with an umbrella. That probably isn't unusual. It was a sunny day. What do you think?
Well, it was raining earlier in the day, and if you look at the Zapruder film especially, you see a number of people are wearing raincoats. A number of women have kerchiefs on, etc. So it was a November day. It had rained earlier in the morning. I had seen an explanation where a news source actually identified the gentleman with the umbrella, and I don't think there's anything there. So I can debunk the umbrella man thing. However, there was a young man standing next to the Umbrella Man that you can only see, that you can't see from the Zapruder film. You can only see from other still photographs that are taken, who appears to be, talking into a walkie-talkie.
That wouldn't be unusual, would it?
Depending on who the gentleman was, absolutely.
Like telling them fire?
It could have been a portable radio and he was listening to news coverage of the motorcade.
Sure.
But I mean, I think that's an additional area that's ripe for further investigation.
Paul, what about the babushka lady?
The babushka lady is kind of interesting. And again, you can kind of see this very, very clearly in the Zapruder film. There's a woman who's bundled up in a raincoat and she has a kerchief around her head, so has the name Babushka Lady, and she appears to have a movie camera, and she appears to be filming. Now, there's a woman who used to work in a gentleman's club right next to Jack Ruby's club, Jack Ruby's Carousel Club, and her name is Beverly Oliver, and she claims to be the Babushka Lady. A friend of hers had given her this new prototype movie camera. But the film was surrendered to law enforcement that day and has never been returned to her and has never been seen since. So, again, we can't even determine with any reasonable degree of certainty who the Babushka Lady was. I mean, I know Beverly Oliver has been very active the past 30 years saying, I'm the Babushka Lady. I dated Jack Ruby briefly. He was a nice guy. He was a gentleman. I don't think he was involved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But again, absent like independent confirmation of some of that, you really can't be. You really can't rest too much on that.
Paul, why are they still holding back on records and documents? I mean, they've released some more, but they still got a whole bunch they're holding back.
Yeah, they have as many as several thousand that they may be holding back. And again, I'm not sure what national security issues could still be lingering after 55 years, but that's a question for the National Archives. We can only speculate about what might be in there. What conclusions may be drawn, et cetera. But until they're released, and until they're released in a non-heavily redacted form, we're not going to know.
Amazing.
And I'm hoping some of those might be some of those films that are missing.
And people can see the Orville Nix film on YouTube, you say?
Yeah, the Orville Nix film is there, and his granddaughter, Gail Nix Jackson, wrote an excellent book about the Orville Nix film. And she talks about there was some criticism of the film. It was, back then, it wasn't like in the age of videotape or cell phone cameras. You had indoor film, you had outdoor film, and apparently some experts say that he was using indoor film. Which produced a rather grainy image. But if you look at the version that's available on YouTube, both at full speed and at that 25% speed, it appears to be this, it's just a major piece of evidence for this case that's been, quite frankly, been denigrated and disregarded over the years. The U.S. government paid Orville Nix $16 million, paid Abraham Zapruder's family $16 million for the film as a valuable piece of history.
$16 million?
Yeah. And the Zapruder...
And Life magazine paid him too, didn't they, in the beginning?
It was big money back then.
It's like $1 million today, at least.
Oh, at least, at the very, very least. And I think Nix got $5,000 for his film from, not from Life, but from another company. But again, I think the Nix film is even more significant than the Zapruder film.
All right, stay with us, Paul. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Daboli with us as we talk about his thoughts about the Kennedy assassination. And, of course, don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. Well, we're going to have a live show for you on Thanksgiving night. So after you're done with your festivities, come and join us wherever you may be. If you need to get back to work, if you're in a truck, if you're on police duty, keep your radio tuned to Coast AM. And, of course, we'll have our phone calls with you, and it's an interactive program. But a live show on Thanksgiving night, you know the drill, live on holidays, to be sure. And welcome back. Our final segment with Paul Daboli. We're going to take your calls as well. Paul, tell us about your thoughts about the spent shell casings that were found on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository.
Oh, sure. This is really interesting. Right by the window where the sniper's perch was, there were three spent shell casings that were found by Dallas police investigators. Two of the shell casings were right under the window, and there was a third probably about 2.5 feet away. One of the speculation is that one of those shell casings, the one that was found further away, was actually a space holder shell casing that was actually inside the Mannlicher Carcano rifle. And a lot of experienced people with that weapon would keep a spent shell casing in the chamber to prevent dirt buildup and to prevent the rifle from misfiring, because it really was not a very, you know, well-made weapon.
Exactly.
So if three shots were fired and one of the shell casings, it was a space holder, and they only found the other two shell casings, what happened to the third shell casing? And also there's some irregularity as to the bullet count in the rifle. It held a 6-round clip. When the gun was discovered, there were 2 rounds in it, which would lead a reasonable person to conclude that 4 rounds might have been expended. So, you know, the question is, again, how many shots did Oswald actually fire? And the other thing that just doesn't kind of jive either is that most trained snipers, and he would have had some basic sniper training while he was in Marine Corps boot camp, police the brass. They pick up the spent shell casings, after the weapon's been fired. And he took the time to hide the gun, yet he didn't take an extra 3 seconds to police the brass, as they say. Then if you fast forward ahead, when Tippett was shot, some of the witnesses describe Oswald, the shooter, as policing the brass there. So a reasonable question is, if you're in the confines if you're the only person on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, you don't take time to police the brass, but you're out in the middle of the street, you shoot a police officer, but you stop to pick up the brass there. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Now, he was found in the movie theater, right?
Correct.
And what was he doing hiding out in there?
He wanted to go to a place where, and it was funny because the person who called the police to the movie theater didn't report him as looking like the person that had shot President Kennedy, because he wasn't even wanted for that later on. He snuck in without paying, and that's why they called the police. But, you know, traffic's really high. Police officers have just been shot. Dallas is on the 1963 version of lockdown because the president has just been shot. You have to find a place to hide. You can't be too obvious. A dock and movie theater, on some level, might make sense.
And he had a gun, obviously.
Yep, he did have a 38 revolver. But the thing that I found interesting was that the witnesses that describe the shooting of Officer Tippett describe him as policing the brass. So he was found with a revolver, but the spent cartridges stay in the cylinder, you know, that rotating cylinder, until you purposely eject them. So then one question for the Tippett murder is, well, if he was picking up the spent shell casings, that would seem to indicate that it was some type of automatic, like a .45,
mm-hmm.
That had spent the shell casing. So where did that go? So where did that gun go, and why was he found with a .38?
Right. A lot of inconsistencies there.
There really is. And, I mean, and one of the things that I talk about is confluence theory. Oh, we have this inconsistency, we have this coincidence, we have another inconsistency, et cetera. And at a certain point, all of these things flow together that would lead a reasonable person to conclude that there is a conspiracy here. And it's just more than random chance. It's more than a random confluence of events. And that's what we're looking at. That's the premise of my portion of the investigation, anyhow.
Let's go to the phones, Paul, east of the Rockies. Mike's with us in Norristown, Pennsylvania. Michael, take it away.
Yeah, hi. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone.
You too, Mike.
I got a theory on that first shot that hit Kennedy, but before I get into that, I want to comment on this conspiracy theory thing.
Sure.
The fact that his brother was shot a few years later, and now they're saying that John Jr. was going to run for political office. This really makes me think that there was someone out to get the Kennedys, and for a reason, I don't know whether it's because of their religion, because they were Catholic, or maybe it was because they're Democrats. But that really leads way to the theory that I think there was definitely a conspiracy with a group out to get him, to get the Kennedys, period.
Well, that's very possible. I still contend that the mob had a lot to do with it. They wanted Bobby Kennedy off their back, and they figured the best way to do that is not to take out Bobby, but to take out the brother John, the president. And I've always believed that's the main motivation, Paul.
Well, I think there was a lot of mob interest in the Kennedy administration and in the way that they governed and the way that Bobby Kennedy actually behaved towards organized crime while he was attorney general was some uncharacteristic issue there. But if you look at the RFK assassination, and I've been on your show, you know, to talk about that in the past.
Yes.
It appears as though that the fatal bullet from RFK did not come from Sirhan Sirhan, that it came from a second source.
That's what we hear.
And, so you would have to say, okay, why is this, you know, what's the motivation of the second source? And, you know, you can look at, you know, U.S. support of Israel is an issue for Sirhan Sirhan. I don't think he was that up on current affairs, et cetera. But it appears as though that somebody in the entourage was armed, and perhaps he shouldn't have been.
And to this day, he has no recollection.
He has no recollection
of what happened.
He claims the mind control thing, et cetera. I think Bobby Kennedy was really an unfortunate accident. You had a mentally imbalanced person who showed up there for some purpose other than to say hello. And then there's ample ballistic evidence to indicate that somebody else in the entourage was armed.
Right.
I think it was a series of accidental discharges.
It could be, because they did find a gun in Sirhan's hand.
They did. But, I mean, you know, there were powder burns on Bobby Kennedy's jacket, yet Sirhan was never close.
He was never
closer than 3 feet to him. Bobby Kennedy, he was facing away from Bobby Kennedy. Again, all of the ballistics are inconsistent. And if you look at the physical evidence, which we can't do anymore because the Ambassador Hotel was just torn down a few years ago, it does appear as though that there were as many as 13 shots that were fired that day. Sirhan's gun holds 8. There's 5 that are unaccounted for.
Okay, let's go to the phones again. Let's go to David in Arizona, first-time caller. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? A couple of quick things. Hi to my friend K6MWT out there in Los Angeles. I want to get that out of the way.
Sure.
Second is, if you look at the Zapruder film, and it was not a gunshot that killed JFK. It was a shrapnel blast from the front passenger seat. The reason why the driver looked back was to make sure that he was lined up when he pulled the detonation cord on the shape charge, and that's what killed the president.
What do you think of that, Paul?
I don't think shape charges were as evolved then as they are now. And there was no evidence in the limousine that would indicate any type of explosion, although the crime scene wasn't secured, and we've all seen pictures in the front of Parkland Hospital where people are actually cleaning the car and putting the top on, et cetera. If you look at... there was an Associated Press photographer named Ike Altgens that was there photographing, and he took the great photograph that shows President Kennedy grabbing his throat. It shows all of the other Secret Service agents in the follow-up car looking back at the Texas School Book Depository, yet Clint Hill is looking forward. If you zoom in on the windshield, and I've seen several photo enlargements of this, it appears as though there is a bullet hole in the windshield of President Kennedy's limousine as well, which would be inconsistent with, you know, a small shape.
Well, and ironically, Paul, during my last hour, we had a call from the son of an employee at the Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan, who said that his father was one of those who replaced the windshield when they shipped the car to Ford Motor headquarters immediately after the assassination. And he said there was a bullet hole from the front.
Well, actually, the windshield is part of is a Warren Commission investigation, and there is the bullet hole there, so that's undisputable.
Why would they replace the windshield so quickly?
Heavily armored limousine. There probably weren't a lot of them floating around in 1963. They wanted it ready for Johnson's use, but ironically, he never rode in that limousine.
I wouldn't.
After that event. No, I wouldn't either. So.
No. Too much tragedy there, to be sure. When we last talked, we were talking about Oswald's Minox camera, and you were really fascinated about that.
Well, because it was such a high-end camera for such a person of limited means to actually have. And again, the Minox camera was going for around $300 in 1950.
That's like a $7,000 camera today or something.
Yeah, so basically you don't feed your kid for 3 months to buy the Minox camera. But there was a discussion board that one of your listeners had started afterwards, and they were theorizing that it might have been a light meter. But when you go back through the Dallas Police Department inventory of all the things that were taken from his house, it does describe a light meter. And then it describes, several items later, describes the Minox camera. So the fact that somebody might have mistaken the camera for a light meter doesn't hold water with the way the evidence was inventoried.
What did his wife ever say about all this? Was it Marina Oswald?
Marina Oswald Porter, she's living in Oklahoma right now. I've reached out to her a couple of times, but I haven't been able to kind of catch her. But she maintained that her husband was with the CIA, that he was part of a grand plot, that he didn't operate alone. And again, I have no reason to doubt what she's saying. So, but I personally haven't had a chance to question her yet. But I mean, she has made several news appearances, surprisingly few over the last 55 years. But she claims that her husband was part of a greater conspiracy, and she's not saying too much because she's concerned for the safety of her children.
It's amazing that there are eyewitnesses still from that event.
There are. There's a few around. Fred Betzner, who took a series of photographs, is still around. I used to talk regularly with Marianne Moorman, who took the famous badge man photograph.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't spoken to her in a couple of years. I hope she's doing well. Clint Hill is in his late 80s, and he's going strong. He's in better shape than I am.
He's the one who jumped on the back, right?
He is. He was the sole person to react. Now, there's some stories floating around, too, about, I think the History Channel did an investigation that theorizes that an inexperienced agent in the follow-up car might have had an accidental discharge.
Right.
When that car accelerated when they took off to the hospital. But there's a few inconsistencies with that. There's a photograph floating around of the follow-up car, following President Kennedy's limo while they're on the highway heading to the hospital. And the guy's clutching an M16 rifle. But again, it's 1963. The M16 wasn't, a standard infantry weapon for the Army until some time after that. I've spoken with Jerry Blaine, who was also a member of the president's detail. He was on duty at the White House when that happened. They were given additional heavy weaponry when they were standing in their post, and he was armed with a Thompson submachine gun. So it doesn't make sense that the White House would have Thompsons, yet the people in the field traveling with the president would have this new, relatively untried weapon as part of their armament in the presidential.
Joe in the Bronx, take it away, Joseph.
George, happy Thanksgiving.
You too, Joe.
Happy Thanksgiving to your guest. Yeah, I wanted to ask your guest about the John K. Latimer ballistics on the JFK assassination. Can you shed a little light on how accurate those were?
Latimer did do a number of studies, and he was very, very experienced. But, I mean, I think there were a number of points that Latimer refused to make, in his analysis. And at this point, we're, as a society, shying away from the lone gunman theory. And I think a lot of Latimer's research reinforces the multiple shooter theory. But again, there were some holes and inconsistencies, and I'm just going to kind of withhold commenting on that at this point. But you can always read that in my book when it comes out in May.
We've got Carlos in San Francisco. Go ahead, Carlos. Carlos?
Yes. Hi, gentlemen.
Take it away, sir.
Okay. So the discussion has basically been limited to the event, and then, of course, the involvement of the mafia and of the Secret Service. And Mr. Norrie in this discussion has alluded to Treasury certification. And so my question, number one, is, Bill Cooper, the late Bill Cooper, he asserts that part of the reason or the biggest part of the motivation for the elimination of JFK is because he wanted to take us off the gold standard. And given that the Secret Service, the jurisdiction, was the Treasury Department, I'd like for your guests to comment on that.
Okay, and we've only got a minute left, Paul, but give it your best shot.
I'll be really brief if I can. If you've ever interviewed any of the Secret Service agents that were assigned to the Kennedy detail, and you just hear the raw emotion in their voices, it is unlikely that the Secret Service, who was charged with a very, very sacred duty of protecting the president, was at all involved. This keeps coming back to kind of a geopolitical issue. President Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs invasion, wanted to take the CIA and break it into 1,000 pieces. And if you look at all of the evidence, including some of the Oswald evidence, it does lead straight back to the Central Intelligence Agency. And I think it's really, really tough just to kind of impute some type of motive in the Secret Service as being accomplices. It doesn't fit with the facts, and it doesn't fit with their focus and with their duty.
Paul, what's the name of the new book when it comes out?
The name of the book is called Conspiracy 101. It is due out in May, and the subtitle is An Authoritative Examination of the Greatest Conspiracies in American Politics. And I have you to thank for getting me to write that book.
And we're going to have you back on when it's out, all right?
I can't wait. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Paul. You take care of yourself. Have a great Thanksgiving. Folks, we'll have a live show on Thanksgiving night. Enjoy your meal or whatever you do, but join us at night on Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Donna Walker, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Greg Bishop, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Badal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.